Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we're joined by former Florida Congressman David Jolly. Hey, thanks for joining us again. You're becoming a quasi-regular now, Congressman.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Charlie. Appreciate what you do.
Actually, you know, I shouldn't call you Congressman. It's like new dad. We should have a title for like new dad, right?
You know, I'm a new dad. I'm not too late in life, but I guess later. I'm in my late 40s, and it is awesome. Everything about it is just awesome. I love it.
Cling to that when you're attending soccer matches in the rain into your 70s. Just, I want you to hold on to that.
My biggest concern, Charlie, is that actuarial table now looks very different than when I was in my 20s.
It does, actually. Okay, so let's talk about where we're at right now. It is Friday morning as we're discussing this, and the president did something somewhat uncharacteristic for himself. He kind of walked back the send her back chant, but characteristically, he lied about it, saying that he really didn't like it. He tried to stop it by talking very quickly. Of course, the videotape shows that's not true. So give me your take of the state of play right now of the president backing off of... And your reaction to the president backing off from the rather dramatic send her back chant from the other night?
Well, in a superficial way, I think this follows the pattern of Donald Trump's behavior in moments of self-created crisis, where he's always looking to escape accountability. And what I mean by that is you can look at Charlottesville and other moments where it seemed his advisors got to him and said, wait, that's a little too hot. Maybe his Hill allies got to him and said, that's a little too hot. And so he backs off. But then as it gets reported that he apologized or backed off, he'll lean back in. And I fully expect him to lean back in and embrace the champ before all this is over. But we cannot get away from the fact that he injected this poison into the national narrative on Sunday when unsolicited, he went to Twitter and said, it's time for them to go back. And what is, you know, I look back at the tweet thread because he continues to try to evolve it to, he was saying, you can leave if you want to. His last tweet on Sunday said, you cannot leave fast enough. He was saying, send her back on Sunday, and he knows it. And take it just in a very general sense, had the president never launched this screed on Sunday, would the crowd in North Carolina naturally started chanting, send her back, unsolicited, if the president had not created this environment? No, of course not. This is on him. He bears the blame.
Yeah, and Laura Trump is on Fox saying that, you know, something like, well, no, he didn't really mean that it wasn't raised. It was just a few people in front. Well, she actually spoke before him, warming the crowd up, telling people
right.
to leave. So my reaction to this was pretty much the same as yours. You know, and I said yesterday, you know, it's just ridiculous for the president, you know, for Trump to suggest that, you know, he didn't really like this because he basically laid the bonfire with sticks of dynamite, poured kerosene on it, and then dropped a match and went, whoa, I didn't expect that to happen. So where do you fall in this continuum of this is Donald Trump, master tactician, managing to gin up his base while making the squad the face of the Democratic Party versus the, nah, he just rolled out of bed, saw something on Fox and Friends and tweeted it out?
I'm with the latter. I don't think Donald Trump is a master tactician. I think he's a boorish populist. And what we saw was the boorish populist Trump that either intentionally peddles in racism and xenophobia or is so ignorant about it that he steps into it and then finds himself defending it. What he did, and I do think, Charlie, this will become, I think we will hear these chants again. We're foolish to think we'll never hear these chants again. And even if the president tries to continue to stay arm's length from the chants, the party is going to embrace love it or leave it. And that is just as dangerous, if not more so.
Okay,
because
this is the
subtlety.
Right. So this, by the way, this is great minds thinking alike, because that's exactly what I predict, is that they may not do the send her back, but they will embrace love it or leave it. Now, that's crude. It's dumb. You know, it has all sorts of, you know, the same sort of, you know, dog whistle message. But I think Republicans will embrace it. They will sigh relief with relief because it's not actually worse. And you can already see them sort of pivoting to that, you know, love it or leave it, which to me is like a 1965 bumper sticker from, you know, the Bircher down the street. But now it's become mainstream Republican.
Because it is equally as dangerous as center back. And this is where his Hill allies, Lindsey Graham and so forth, if they don't realize that, and I believe they do, then they're fools. Because here's what Love It or Leave It is saying. First of all, it requires his constituency to immediately accept the notion that Ilhan Omar and Ocasio-Cortez don't love the country. They do love the country. That's why they ran for office. What Donald Trump is doing is he is equating love with agreement with his political decisions. If you don't agree with Donald Trump's political decisions, you must not love the country and therefore you must leave. So if Ilhan Omar doesn't agree with putting kids in cages, she should leave. If Ilhan Omar doesn't believe in injecting greater instability and insecurity on the world stage, then she should leave. If she doesn't believe it's right for Donald Trump to criminally obstruct justice in the face of the Mueller probe, then she should leave. If she doesn't think it's right for Donald Trump to criminally conspire in a campaign finance violation entered into judgment in the Southern District of New York, then Omar should leave. That is the context that he is setting up. And ultimately what it is doing is it is quieting dissent. And he knows it. It is suggesting you may not dissent with the president. If so, you don't love the country and you should leave. And, you know, interestingly, Charlie, you and I have lived through the Republican circles for over a generation now. The disappointment I felt this week was in watching Republican leaders on Capitol Hill scramble to find a logical way to insulate this president politically. When what I did is I turned to look to the Constitution, truly, to start reading what some of our founders tried to teach us about this moment. And I say that not to pat myself on the back, not at all, but because we're faced with this moment in our nation that we should be asking really hard questions and looking for some serious answers. And the broad takeaway from my returning to some of the constitutional writings, the founders' writings, is that every bit of our Constitution was written to protect the individual's freedom to dissent. It wasn't written to protect the majority. It was written to protect the individual and their right to dissent from the imposition and the groupthink of a majority. And so in some ways, I see a reason to celebrate Omar a bit, which is ironic because the different political paths we come from, she is exactly the embodiment of the very tenets of the Constitution that our founders were brilliant in constructing. And so then that pushes me back to look at the likes of Lindsey Graham and Kevin McCarthy and frankly Mitt Romney and those who refuse to go to the mat right now to defend Ilhan Omar. This is what they should be defending, not a man that they have spent 2 to 3 years insulting and then he got elected and they run to his.
Okay, and I agree with all of that, but let me play devil's advocate with you for a while. I also don't, you know, think that the president plays three-dimensional chess or that he's a great strategist, and what I've described him as having is this reptilian cunning. And I think where he went too far with the you know, send her back is it's one thing to have reptilian cunning. It's another thing to peel off the mask and really, you know, reveal the lizard face underneath, and I think he went too far. But the reality is that in his reptilian cunning, he knows that he has to make this a choice election, not a referendum on him. And he wants to run against radical socialists. And if he can run against radical socialist brown women, all the much better. So he has picked his enemies. He basically wants to make Ilhan Omar and AOC the face of the Democratic Party. And this week, they are getting more attention than the Democratic candidates for president. And even though the Democrats in Congress, I think, have come to realize that the squad is absolutely toxic, that they are reckless, that they have been narcissistic. Ilhan Omar is continuing to push her pro-BDS resolution. And even though Nancy Pelosi recognizes what a gift they are to Donald Trump, now they are forced to defend them. And yes, on principle, they need to be defended as Americans and patriots. But the reality of, you know, tactile politics is that Donald Trump is doing what he wanted to do, right? He wants to cast the party in a certain way, and they are the perfect symbols. Now I've heard a bunch of people trying to rationalize this over the last 24 hours saying, okay, this was not about race. It's not about gender. It's about radical socialism. Well, you notice that he was not leading chants about Bernie Sanders. He wasn't leading chants about Elizabeth Warren. He was leading chants about Ilhan Omar. And so to that extent, this may be a terrible miscalculation, but it's very intentional for Donald Trump, and he relishes it, and he thinks he's winning.
It is absolutely intentional. He is not telling Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to go back where they came from, or to your point, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. No, he's doing it to four women of color, and, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragically mournful, if you will, that three of the women, as we know, were born right here in the United States. But the president, because they are women of color, he sees U.S. citizenship as uniquely a white European descendant privilege that he just assumed they must come from somewhere else. To your point, though, I guess I don't give Donald Trump too much credit, because I think the narrative of 2020 and their campaign is already baked in. Every single presidential candidate and congressional candidate is going to get tagged with the politics. In past cycles, we've seen them tag every Democrat as a Nancy Pelosi Democrat. And that's simply because the poll numbers show that it works. In the 18 midterm, when Republican candidates started saying their Democratic opponents were socialists, I thought that was an odd hit. And I remember going to a consultant for an incumbent Republican, and I said, does the socialist tag really work? And he said, it works better than tagging our opponent as a Nancy Pelosi Democrat. And I found myself in the last week or two reflecting on really how you impose a political frame, if you will, around your opponent, and how it takes time. That now we're almost a year from the last election cycle in the late summer and fall of 18. And now socialism is kind of baked into the political conversation. This has been a deliberate strategy by Republicans. So not only will Donald Trump paint his Democratic opponent as a socialist in the likes of AOC, just like every Democrat will say every Republican is as bad as Roy Moore and, who knows, David Duke, right? That Democrats can do that to Republicans as well. I think it's going to get worse. I think Donald Trump will paint his opponent with criminality. I think Donald Trump's ability to beat his opponent is to increase their net unfavorability so high. And the way he's going to do that is, whoever his opponent is, he'll make up a reason why his constituency, Donald Trump's constituency, has to question whether or not the Democratic nominee is actually a criminal that needs to be investigated.
Okay, we've discussed this question many times on this podcast, and so I apologize to the listeners if they think that they've heard it, but I want to get your take on this. Who's going to decide this election? Donald Trump thinks this election will be decided by white working class voters in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, people who voted for him, who might be, say, Democrat curious, but if they think that the Democrats, in fact, are radical, hate America, do not share their values, you know, might reluctantly vote for him again, or enthusiastically vote for him because they fear the choice. He's trying to create that, you know, clash of civilizations type thing. So he thinks that those are the voters, or the voters not just of the base, but voters who have negative feelings about both candidates, but in 2016 broke very, very heavily for him. I think he won the people who dislike both him and Hillary. He won those folks by 21 points, and he's counting on doing that again. So he thinks that's what's going to determine the 2020 election. Who do you think is going to determine the 2020 election?
I actually agree with that. The metropolitan suburbs will determine the Congress, but the Electoral College will rely on exactly those states that he is playing to. And I think he continues to deploy through his messaging an Electoral College strategy. I say that, Charlie, as I'm rolling through central Pennsylvania, where this is the heart of Trump country right now. And it's a fascinating moment for me to kind of be informed by what a region that is so pro-Trump, how they view the news cycle. if you will. I do think, you know, a lot of times, I know we've talked about this, who are the Democrats? Are they going to go left? Are they going to go middle and so forth? You know, I've come down to view the Democratic primary through this lens, and it's this. I think the Democrats are going through one of their generational fights for the heart and soul of the party. Who are they? Republicans do the same thing. But the Democrats are going through this fight for the heart and soul of the party at a time that it just so happens they also have to choose a candidate to go up against Donald Trump. And that's almost two parallel paths. And I think that's the challenge that Democrats have in front of them, which is, it is right to fight for the heart and soul of the party. Are they a Medicare for All party, or are they simply a public option party? Are they a revolution party or an evolution party? That's an important conversation for Democrats to have. They're just having to have it in cycle in one of the most consequential presidential elections we face. And they've got to figure out how to balance the family conversation with the electability conversation.
You know, I want to go back to by the way, that's absolutely correct. I want to go back to the chant the other night, which, you know, you and I have had this conversation before. And by the way, here's an advantage of podcast over writing, because I actually tried to write this morning, because, you know, the problem of becoming numb to Donald Trump, the fact that this is taking place when we get all this new information coming out of the, you know, Southern District of New York about his attempts to, you know, quash any information about Stormy Daniels, and this new video out with him, you know, as Jeffrey Epstein being a, you know, BFF with, you know, putting his hand on a woman's, you know, rear end. I mean, it's that's almost like noise in the background. So I was going to write something called, I was going to call it Numb and Nummer. But you can't really say that. No, it wrote it out. I thought it was really clever until I realized that everybody would look at it and go, numb and number. You know, I mean, what? Now, if I say it to you, you see, you get it.
Oh, that's
it's like,
good.
It's like,
that's
numb right. And number. I can say this. Maybe I should save this for television. But this danger of becoming numb, and, you know, sort of rolling your eyes and saying, oh, that again. But there was something qualitatively different about that sender back. And I've heard this some anecdotally from some folks who generally have not gotten, you know, viscerally involved in this. Somebody said to me, you know, this is the first time I've actually been afraid that he's, you know, sort of opening this Pandora's box, this moment of hell. And it really did strike me that, you know, these things – you know, look, Donald Trump did not create racism or xenophobia. I mean, those are pre-existing conditions. Let's stipulate that. You know, but, you know, just because something's a burning, and I wrote this yesterday, something is because it's a burning ember doesn't mean it's going to become this massive conflagration. Just because something's latent doesn't mean it's going to metastasize. And so what he's doing, he's stoking this. That, you know, in the past, you know, we're not like either racist or not racist or this or that. You know, we can go either way if we're influenced. You know, this is why your parents tell you, you know, don't treat people that way. Don't have that attitude. And now he's giving people permission to think and react and treat people in a certain way. You know, he doesn't create the worst, but he brings it out. And we don't know where that leads. We don't know how much ugliness there's out there.
No, Charlie, I would even say he's celebrating it. He's creating environments where racism and xenophobia is considered to be equal in intellectual thought in the United States and deserves a place within the political arena just as any other position does. You know, I often have to look back at the history of the Republican Party, because I know our friends on the left say, hey, Republicans have always relied on racism, and they point to the Southern strategy. And I look back at the Southern strategy and I think, you know, there's truth to it. I think Republicans were willing to light the fire, if you will, and maybe even stoke the flames in deploying the Southern strategy. But then they kind of walked away and said, we don't know who started the fire. Donald Trump pulled up a campfire seat and started roasting s'mores on the fire. That's the difference. He is celebrating this, saying, you've got a home and this is who we are as a country. And, you know, it goes back, though, to how numb are we? When I was looking at the founders' writings, as I was speaking to earlier, as we put this in the lens of all things Donald Trump, I think this week will end up defining him and be one of those moments that is quickly recalled, along with Charlottesville and Helsinki and these other moments where the president just truly turns his back on our ideals. But I think for Trump, for the Lindsey Grahams, the Kevin McCarthys, the Rubios, those who won't speak out or are equivocal when they do, their legacies will be fleeting on all of this. But I actually think Ilhan Omar, remarkably, is this week securing a very special place in history. One of a very few handful of refugees who ascended to be in the United States Congress is now a central character in this 230-year conversation about the protections that surround an American citizen's right to dissent, right to confront and challenge the decisions being made by their government. And I think history will look back and will remember that this was a moment, again, that our founders envisioned, that the rights of Ilhan Omar are protected. And the reason why is Congress has really never seen ideologically someone like Ilhan Omar. She challenges the foreign policy dogma that for generations has been embraced by Democrats and Republicans. And I think Ilhan Omar will lose the contest of ideas because I think it is out just so far out of the mainstream that she won't win the ideological fight. But this will be a moment where we recognize that she is entitled to that platform that we each are entitled to, because 700,000 of her neighbors in Minnesota said, we want Ilhan Omar to be our voice in Washington.
No,
and that was how the system was designed.
Well, I do think, you know, this is where you have to, you know, sort of at least raise the flag and say, you know, she will lose the battle of ideas because many of her ideas are toxic. And, you know, she has flirted with anti-Semitism. So, and I know people on the left hate the idea of both sidesism, but, you know, there has been something toxic about some of her rhetoric and her tactics and the fact that she is pushing this BDS resolution at this moment. And also, I do think there's been a certain recklessness with AOC and her chief of staff, and that's why there's so much anger among Democrats at the way they have behaved. But you are right. But again, you're talking about two different universes here. You're talking about, you know, the Constitution's demand of I don't know what the tolerance is the right word, you know, but of respect for their ability to say these things, even if they are wrong, versus Donald Trump's, you know, rather effective play to the base that these folks, this is what I'm up against. So I'm going to go back to this sort of breaking the seal and making people think in a different way. You're driving through central Pennsylvania, and I'm sure you're going through this mental image thinking, how are these things playing here, right? What are these people,
That's right.
They think, how do they react, which is probably very different than people in Chris Hayes's green room, right?
It's a different world.
I was flying back home yesterday, and I landed in Minneapolis, probably around the same time that Ilhan Omar was landing. I didn't see her, but you know, it's because it's a big airport.
Did you get a cheering welcome?
No, I did not. But it was interesting because you land in Minneapolis and you become, and at least I was thinking, become very, very conscious of, you know, the number of Somalians who are there, the number of immigrants who work there or traveling through there. And it suddenly, you know, I started thinking, okay, so given this context that the president, you know, this conflagration that the president has set up, are people looking at them now in a different way, in a way that they did not before? Or are they willing to indulge reactions to them that they would have suppressed before, looking at them thinking, do they hate America? Should they be here? Why are they here? Are they an alien presence? So the president is not just doing what he's doing. The question is he changing the country? Is he changing it by allowing this sort of thing or encouraging this sort of thing? Because I could feel, as I was just thinking, so if I am a MAGA head, how am I reacting to these people around me? And am I reacting in a way that is different from 2 years ago? And you and I both know lots of people who are sort of on the fringes of politics who show up at rallies and stuff. And it strikes me that these are people who, in a different world, with a President Bush or a President Rubio or a President Dave Jolly, would be just the salt of the earth. They would go to church. They would treat people with respect. They would not be engaging in this. And yet, because of what's happening, because of listening to Donald Trump, these same people who could have gone in a different direction are now the ones who are chanting and doing these things. Am I being naive here? Are they the same people?
I don't think so.
Or were they always bigots, you know?
No, I think they are following a leader. And so it's right to question their decision to follow this leader. But they weren't naturally going down that path. because that path naturally had us in the year 2000 when Ilhan Omar raised her hand and took her oath of allegiance to the United States as a refugee being naturalized as a citizen. She was then resettled in the Minnesota community. And there are always challenges in our refugee resettlement program when the United States chooses a metro area to resettle a large population of a common heritage. And so a lot of Somalis were resettled in the Minneapolis area. That comes with challenges, naturally it does, within a community. But as a nation, because of political leadership, we worked with the Minneapolis community and their local leaders worked to embrace the Somali community and create an environment where all were welcome. 19 years later, we have a president saying, maybe they shouldn't be welcome. And we have people in North Carolina chanting, send them back. Culturally, I think he is sending us back. I think politically, to your point of how is it viewed in central Pennsylvania and other places, one, the news cycle is not even the same, right? It's just a quick soundbite, should she go back or not? I analogize a lot of this, Charlie, to the debates we've had over decades about a flag desecration constitutional amendment. And I know that sounds crazy, but I remember as a young Republican working on Capitol Hill and Republicans wanted to pass a constitutional amendment to ban desecration of the flag. And I thought, well, that's strange that we would order freedom. Why aren't we working to build a country where nobody would want to burn a flag as opposed to prohibiting someone's ability to burn the flag? And we see this type of political adoption of patriotism when we see this flag burning amendment every 10 years come up and Republicans are quick to say, yes, you shouldn't be allowed to burn the flag because it makes you a bad patriot. And Democrats say you shouldn't burn the flag, but we should allow the freedom of people to express themselves however they wish. I find that as we wrestle with some of the politics of Ilhan Omar, she confronts what are some traditional norms of Democrats and Republicans, and we will disagree with her on many of those norms. But the greater fight is what we should be fighting to have in common, which is the freedom of all of us to express our beliefs, just as you and I do, Omar should do as well. I think that nuance is lost in your medium information, electoral college constituencies that Donald Trump is relying to put him over the line.
Well, and that's also one of those norms that's under attack with the new illiberalism that you see both on the left and the right. And I'm going to defend that. I mean, the speech police on the left, which we've been talking about for years, but also this new illiberalism sure. on the right, which basically casts all politics as Flight 93 elections forever, that it's life or death, clash of civilizations.
Right.
Therefore, there's no room for simple tolerance of other people's opinions or being concerned about process. It is about winning. It is about, you know, saving our civilization. And what are we prepared to do if we have done that? So, and again, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about before. I think in terms of leadership, after 9/11, what George W. Bush did by saying, we cannot blame all Muslims, we need to, that outreach effort was immensely important and I think was effective for that time. And, you know, I was thinking about John McCain when he pushed back against that woman. I know that you tweeted about that as well.
That's
how much
right.
You missed that. But George W. Bush also, in a very difficult time when anti-Muslim passions could have been stoked, imagine if there had been a Donald Trump in the White House as the political
That's
cultural
right.
leader at that moment, how ugly things would have been. And I don't think that George Bush has gotten enough credit for the restraint and the number of people who I think, you know, could have gone either way, who because of that leadership saw somebody, you know, in a headscarf or a turban and said, okay, you know what, I'm not going to take it out on them. I'm not going to blame them.
That's right. George Bush went to a mosque. And, you know, you recall the McCain moment as well. Imagine the other night, and it shouldn't be too hard for us to imagine this. Imagine if that chant broke out and the president had with his hand said, no, that's not what we're going to chant. She deserves to be here. And then could go on and viscerally attack her politics. But imagine if he had done that. That's not too hard of a leadership expectation for us to have. My greatest concern about this president, and I may have said it in one of our earlier conversations between you and I, is if we are to face a moment of true national crisis, the president has worked so hard to sow division and to elevate his political rise by sowing division. I don't know that we could unite like we did behind Bush 43 after 9/11. Recall Bush 43 was a controversial president. Some Democrats said he wasn't legitimate. He had lost the popular vote, won the Electoral College, and had the Supreme Court 90 days later affirm it, or 60 days later. He was considered not too competent. They made fun of the way he spoke. And yet 9/11 happened, and as a nation, we were willing to rally behind a leader that even some on the left questioned his fitness and his legitimacy. But we were able to do that as a country. I don't know, Charlie, that we would rally behind Donald Trump. I would struggle with it. I can speak just for myself. I would struggle to rally behind his competence and his leadership. That's my worry. And I worry that foreign nation states know that. And they know that they may only have 13 or 14 months left to cause havoc here in the United States.
Well, that's the problem with our political culture, is that once things are broken, they're very, very hard to put back and forth. I would love to believe that everything's a pendulum, that, you know, that we get through everything and then things go back to normal, but they don't. And that's just one of them. And they don't go back to normal. Some of the changes are probably good, but the damage here, I think, is incalculable. And I completely agree with Noah Rothman in commentary when he writes, it's going to get worse. It's 2020 is going to be worse, in part because we've lost our political immune system. There are no more calmer, cooler heads to prevail that will prevent us from doing it. So, David Jolly, I know you got some more TV to do, but I appreciate you taking time to come back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Always good to be with you. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.